Hey guys, Andre Harrison back at it once again for episode 8 now. We're already at 8 episodes, crazy. Of the Motorsport 101 podcast here on iTunes and on Harrison101.com. As usual, we've got me and my American co-host, Mr. Ryan King.
Yep, hey everyone.
Yep, good evening, good sir. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing good. Got my list assembled.
Oh, he knows. We've been hyping this up on Twitter for a little while now, and it's Judgment Day, essentially. And, if things don't go well, this could be our final podcast, so who knows what could happen. I'll have to explain that one to my university lecturer. It's like, well, Sue, we were going really well until episode 8 until we pissed off the entire of the F1 community, and now we've got death warrants on our heads. we've got to wait and see how this one rolls out, but I'm confident we'll just about survive, I think. Maybe. But this is going to be kind of like a one-track podcast because next week's show will probably be all about testing because we've got our testing season in Jerez starting next week. We've already had 3 cars revealed, so we're going to be talking a little bit about Force India, Williams, and Lotus revealing their 2015 cars already. And then the big one. Our much requested top 10 drivers of all time lists.
Yeah.
This could go wonderfully, it could go disastrously. Because I'm looking at my list right now and I'm thinking, there's 2 names that could piss a lot of people off here.
Yeah, I got 2 names that are probably going to piss a lot of people off. And even before that, for the next episode, there might be some issues. Because I'm pretty sure I'm probably going to miss the first day of testing because it happens to fall on February 1st.
And what's special about February 1st?
It's this upcoming Sunday.
What is it? What am I missing?
It's Super Bowl Sunday.
Oh, of course. I'm an American football fan. I forgot it was Super Bowl this Sunday.
Yeah.
And my team is in it. Jesus Christ, I'm terrible. Man, I had a complete brain fart on that one. I forgot the 1st of February falls on a Sunday. Whoops. But yeah, so our much requested top 10 drivers of all time list is going to factor in this podcast as well, and may the good Lord help us all. Blah. Yeah. Well, hopefully we'll survive, but I'm holding no promises on that one. So let's talk about the 2015 car, shall we? I mean, did you get a chance to see the Force India press conference last week?
Yeah, I saw it. I saw Ted's notebook and everything.
Yeah, Ted's. I didn't see Ted's notebook on it, to be fair. Like, I know it was done in Mexico, and there was a big feature about Mexico being a renovated track, you know, being back on the calendar, and the work that's going into that. But yeah, it became a bit of an internet running joke that we all just shouted, like, really awful things at the Force India stream for taking so damn long to reveal the car.
Oh, I didn't watch it live, obviously, because I knew it was going to take long just to see what a car looks like.
I know, like, I think I'm right in saying it was something like 48 minutes for them to, after the start of the announced press conference.
That makes LeBron James seem like a considerate human being.
It's like, LeBron, can we get this out of the way real quick here? Like, for those who doesn't know what we're talking about, it's like when ESPN had LeBron James have the decision live on ESPN and dedicated an entire hour of its airtime to announcing he was going to the Miami Heat. Like, I believe it was something like 40 minutes between the time taken for them to start the press conference and them actually revealing the 2015 car.
Oh, but the thing is, with LeBron James, there was payoff. You knew he was going to go to some team. You had no idea which team it was. With the Force India, it's like, yeah, this is what our car looks like.
And yeah, the livery was essentially 70% of what we already know about Force India. Like, a lot of black, but they seem to have replaced the green with a splash of silver.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. We're so happy we have Mercedes power.
Yeah, we're so happy we're going to steal their colour. Basically, it's like we're going to take a page out of McLaren's book. It's like, now McLaren have dumped it. Can we take their livery too, as well as their drivers? So it's like, we took Perez off them last year. Like, we're going to take their livery this year. Like, Perez has slapped silver all over his helmet for next year as well. And to be fair, I still actually quite like the livery. I miss the green, to be honest. I like the green.
Yeah.
It's quite a rare color. It's quite a rare color for Formula One these days. Not since the days of Jaguar, where we're getting, like, big green liveries, apart from that awful one that Honda had a few years ago, where they had the globe thing going on for it, and it was dreadful, in my opinion. I hated that. So I kind of missed the green, but they've gone for, like, the West McLaren style of, like, early 2000s and late 90s, and I think that's actually quite nice. Like, there's nothing wrong with that, yeah. Per se.
There's nothing wrong with that at all. But it's like, I did prefer the 2013 livery they had. You know, the orange, white, and green.
The orange, white, and green. I agree. I like that. I mean, I mean, I was one of those guys that wasn't that high on the black last year. Like we sound like fashion students talking about this. Welcome to the off season. Like, I'm seeing journalists moan about Sebastian Vettel's helmet designs again, and I'm like, yep, there really is nothing to talk about in the break, is there?
It's like, Sebastian Vettel's not even the only person who does it nowadays. Now it's almost every driver.
Yeah, like, Grosjean and Sutil are just as guilty of this crime now as Sebastian Vettel, apparently. But it's like, well, Vettel started it, so he's the godfather of basically pissing off the old men F1 fans out there.
Let's be honest, because Vettel's designs are the only one that are actually good. All the other drivers, when they change designs, are like, eh.
Adrian Sutil's a real hipster when it comes to these things. Like, he had, like, the Monaco one where he went full Bavarian on that one, and I'm like, eh? Grosjean's were kind of weird, but besides the fan helmet where he had people's Twitter names in there, which was kind of a nice touch, even though I couldn't find mine, so I'm still bitter about that. I like occasional of them, like the fighter pilot one Sutil had in America. Like, that was very Top Gun. You know, Maverick and whatnot, but this is how you know the off season's really slow. And when old man journalists are moaning about helmet designs, like, oh well, it's like we had the iconic days of Senna's yellow, and you had, you know, the days of James Hunt just slapping his name on the side of the helmet, and it's like, people,
yeah, like,
are we really having a moan over this?
It's like, you fail to realize that it's like those were cheaper days when they didn't have that much money to spend on helmets. Now they have so much money, they can get a helmet for every session if they wanted to.
Yeah, that's what Seb's been doing, like, the last 2 years now, even when he's not winning. Like, he only retires a helmet if he wins, and he hasn't won now since Brazil 2013.
Yeah.
So it's like, so, you know, that's a thing. But, yeah, I mean, I liked Force India's livery overall. The nose was pretty nice. Like, I know people are going to bitch about the noses all season long because, you know, safety regulations and whatnot. And, you know, you got to have a specific nose these days. Like, no tusks allowed. No Mercedes reverse scoop. No Ferrari. I mean, apparently Ferrari's anteater was the closest to what the new regulations are kind of like. So apparently, according to my man Sasha on Skype, he told me that Ferrari have got an advantage in this department. So it's whatever. But I thought the car looked nice overall, personally.
Yeah, it's like, that's what happens when you give any Formula One team an open book. You're gonna get some results that you rather not desired.
Yeah, like, you might have the Henry de Hoover-style Ferrari front nose from last year, for instance. I don't think that'll be returning. At least I hope not. But, yeah, I mean, Force India's car looked nice. I mean, just make sure the press conferences are shorter next time, VJ. Please, for the love of God. 45 minutes to reveal a damn car. You know what? I felt bad for Nico Hülkenberg standing up there. I watched it live, right? And like, I tweeted this out during time. I was like, they were giving Perez all the airtime, obviously because he's Mexican and the reveal was in Mexico, so I get why that kind of makes sense. But, like, Nico Hülkenberg's just standing there minding his own business, and my response was, like, I wonder if Nico's thinking, you people do realize I whooped this man's ass last year, right?
Yeah, there's like you know I have a factory, you see a Porsche for Le Mans this year, right?
Yeah, it's like, yeah, I'm doing double duty this year. Like, where's my interview?
Like, literally no reason for him to even show up. He should have just stayed home.
Yeah, it's like, you know what? Sit this one out. It's in Mexico. You got Sergio. You don't need me to be there. Like, I'll show up in testing. Like, talk to me later. It's like, it wouldn't have really been a thing. So moving on from that, we had Williams, who revealed theirs in the form of a magazine. It was the F1 Racing magazine that was the first world-exclusive pictures of the new Williams FW37, and as the propaganda had it of the F1 magazine, essentially saying it was a Mercedes beater.
Yeah, a Merc beater. That's like, and use the terms pictures very loosely, because they weren't pictures.
Yeah, like, they were photoshopped images, computer-generated, and it wasn't actually the car. It was just some computer, obviously, generated images and whatnot, and they had the little nib at the front and whatnot, and it's like, I'm not Craig Scarborough, I'm not going to break this down, like, like, detail by tiny detail. I'm not about that life, personally, but, yeah, that was a thing, so everyone went crazy about that one. It's like, oh my god, it's a magazine cover and some computer shots of a Williams, like, that's, let me see the actual car, please. Like, I don't like these digital reveals.
Yeah, especially Lotus today.
Yeah, and obviously, moving on from that, Lotus today revealed their E23. And hooray, no more asymmetrical tusks at the front. Hooray!
Yeah, even though that was pretty much a given.
Yeah, that was a given, to be honest. It looks like Lotus have played it very safe with their front wing by the looks of it. If that's what the one they're going to run with, I'm not sure, because remember when Force India did their reveal last year, I think they were first out of the traps to reveal their wing, and it was like, oh, it's just a placeholder wing. It's like, oh, okay. And then when he saw the actual monstrosity of Force India's front wing and something that wouldn't look out of place on Pornhub.
Oh my god.
But it was like, I'm like, what is that?
It's like, I've literally just been using these car launches to see how much Formula One fans are just foaming at the mouth for anything.
Yeah, it's like, we'll take anything at this point. Like, we can't wait 6 whole days till testing starts.
It's like, oh, like the reactions to the Lotus coming out. Oh my god, it looks fantastic. I'm like, it's pretty much the same as last year, except,
yeah,
like, with the obvious change that we all knew it was coming, that they weren't going to run twin tusk nose.
Yeah, it's like my colleague and fellow F1 community guy, Ryan Littlemore, absolutely lost his damn mind at this. Like, oh my god, it looks beautiful. And I'm like, it's 90% the same as last year. like, why are we all going crazy over this? It's like, we really do miss F1. It's like the old school Super Bowl commercial, like, or like Monday Night Football commercial, remember, with the Manning brothers. And I don't know if you've ever seen this on YouTube, but the one where they're basically playing games to try and fill the time between football seasons. Oh. And it's like, oh, they're playing Go Fish, they're playing Hungry Hippos. And it's like they're playing DDR as well, and it's like, it's the strangest thing ever. Just watching, because, you know, those Manning brothers, they love a good commercial, and I like the fact they can take the piss out of themselves a little bit, which is always fun. But it's just that kind of thing where it's like we're sitting at home just waiting for anything resembling a Formula One car at the moment.
Well, the thing is, it's not like there is, like, no racing at all. There's been plenty of racing since the new year started.
We watched the Rolex 24 this past weekend together, didn't we?
Yeah, we watched Rolex 24. That was, I mean, it was pretty exciting, but eventually we knew who was going to win. Like I predicted, a half an hour in, Ganassi won the prototype class, and the Corvette won the GT class.
Yep, as the form book pretty much suggested, unfortunately. But we have a laugh of it out of it, at least, and, you know, we took the piss out of a SpongeBob-flavored car.
Yep, and a Magnussen got a victory.
It was just Kevin's dad, Jan, rather than Kevin. Whoops. Unfortunately, King's hashtag Save Magnussen campaign is off to a good start, at least the dad's still winning, so that's got to count for something, right?
Yep.
We'll take it. But, yeah, it's like, that's a thing. So, yeah, it's all going to kick off again, because MotoGP testing's next week as well, so that'll be a thing. That's over in Sepang, over in Malaysia. So, yeah. Guys, we haven't got that much longer to wait. Like, McLaren and Ferrari are both revealing their cars on Friday, so, you know, we haven't got that much longer to wait, people. Like, relax. We're going to get through this. We'll survive, so, I promise.
As Aaron Rodgers would say, Relax.
Relax. Relax. So yeah, that's a thing. So let's all comment over these new cars. We'll talk obviously more about testing probably on next week's podcast, so stay tuned for that. Right then. No other news to really report, so...
Well, there was, here in the United States, our Formula One pit reporter decided to just up and leave Twitter.
Oh, yes! Yeah, America's leading F1 journalist and general hilarious former GP2 commentator as well, Will Buxton, just decided to shut down his Twitter page literally in the last couple of hours as we're taping this.
Within the last hour.
Yeah, in the last couple of hours, literally, he has deactivated his Twitter page. Over 50,000 followers on his Twitter page. Probably the leading F1 journalist in America these days. And he decided to just up sticks and leave. Which was just a bit of a surprise to everybody. It's like, hang on a minute, what's he done that for? It was just a bit of a shock to everybody. Even, I'll tell you what, when King logged on, he didn't even know, when he logged on to Skype about an hour ago, that he'd actually gone and done this. So that's how out of the loop he was.
Yeah, I was very out of the loop.
So yeah, that was a bit of a surprise to everybody, more than anything else. I think the tweet that had the pictures had actually been deleted, funnily enough. I'm trying to look for it now on my phone. And it's not here, funnily enough. Hang on. I'm just going to try and see if I can find it here. Oh, here it is. Yeah, I found it. So, yeah, Buxton's last tweets before he deactivated his account were, and I quote, by the way, I said tweets because there's five of them. You'll see the irony in this in a minute. Goes, you know what, guys? I've been thinking about this, and there's more to life than walking around with our noses in our phones. Twitter has its uses, but it also brings out the worst in me. The snarky, sarky, quick-to-judge fool. And honestly, I'm tired of it. I'm sick of summing up life in a pithy 140-character message which, if we're being honest, matters not a yacht. So thank you all for following, but there is so much more to life than this. And I'm letting it all fly past me. Here endeth the tweets. And just like that, Will Buxton sailed into the sunset.
But, I mean... That's how he chooses to quiet himself? Like, he could just choose not to reply to stories on Twitter. He could just choose not to make a comment.
Yeah, it's like, that's the thing. Buxton comments on everything. He really does. And, like, that's something that I've noticed over the last, couple of years. That essentially he's very bite. He bites on a lot of stuff, Buxton. He really does, and he likes being that guy, basically, to chip in. And apparently he started an argument with some people about bad race reports this morning, apparently.
Yeah, that's what I saw when I got up this morning, that it was basically whoever wrote this race report apparently had no idea how punctuation worked.
Yeah, well, that's it. Will Buxton, judge, jury, and executioner on all things grammatical.
It's like he dug in the fangs deep.
Yeah, like, that's pretty raw to be saying someone on a public forum like Twitter. So maybe he's done that and then later regretted what he said. I don't know, it's a weird one. There's not exactly a pinpointing reason besides his own dramatic monologue, which wouldn't look out of place on a Doctor Who episode.
Like, I wouldn't be surprised to see him back eventually.
Yeah, like, friend of the show, and I know he's a keen listener, Danny Brennan. Thanks for listening, my man. Shout out to you, my good sir. He basically called it existential crisis, which is that a really just a fancy way of saying midlife crisis, maybe? Where he said, and I quote... He said, like, he did say something like, what's the point in tweeting? It's all pointless. He is questioning everything that exists in the universe after a year of sitting down thinking, what is life? He'll come out of it. So maybe Will Buxton will go maybe he'll go soul searching on some big expedition somewhere while he thinks about his Twitter account and whether he should come back or not.
Yeah, I mean, I have a feeling he's going to come back because he uses Twitter in the same way we use Twitter to communicate with his friends. To his producer and his cameraman, who he's rarely ever in the same country as.
Yeah, exactly, and he's a big fan of that. And I know he's very close friends with fake Charlie Whiting on Twitter as well, who I don't know why he still uses that fake Charlie Whiting moniker, because we all know it's not really him. And everyone, we all know he's buddies of a...
We know who you are, Mark. You don't have to hide anymore.
Yeah, like, you have like 40,000 followers, like, the game's up. Like, nobody knows you're actually Charlie White, and you've kind of stopped making Charlie White in references, and you're close friends with every pseudo F1 journalist on Twitter these days. Yeah. So it's like,
you've even met the actual Charlie and Bernie at this point. It's up.
It's over. It's over. Like, there's that elite social media F1 tier up there, and like, who would have thought a parody account or a guy who used to be a parody account would be top of the list? Or pretty much at the top of the list at this point. It's crazy. We need to get Ted Kravitz to come down to his level and start, just start fighting with him or something. That'd be hilarious.
Oh, that'd be so funny. Like, I remember watching Ted's Notebook for the car launch, because that's how I saw the car for the first time. I just saw a picture, and it was like, oh, Ted's Notebook. And it was so surreal seeing Ted Kravitz with a cameraman outside a Formula One paddock, like, on a city sidewalk.
Yeah, it's like, what's Ted Kravitz doing here with a cameraman? this looks kind of out of place.
And it was basically like a 20-minute video that was a day in the life of Ted Kravitz, where it's like, it starts off him with the cameraman on the sidewalk, then they, like, you know, go through security, get inside the launch event, then they walk around to the car, then they go say hi to Carlos Slim Jr., then they go say, then they go peek at the drivers, and it was like, this is so surreal.
It's like if Ted Kravitz ever did a video blog, this is what it would probably look like.
Except instead of him holding his own camera, he's a camera guy just flying around.
Yeah, you know, it would be funny as well. Somebody like if he has to sign a form live on camera, and he has to use his actual surname, which isn't Kravitz.
Oh my god! Like, honestly,
yeah, did you know that Kravitz is not his real surname?
Yeah, I knew, but I mean, Ted Kravitz would be the best YouTube F1 personality ever if he tried the video blog F1.
Yeah. Oh man, he'd blow me right out of the water. Like, there's no doubt about that. That'd be hilarious. But as I said, no, Ted actually named his surname after the musician Lenny Kravitz. Yeah, believe it or not, it really is as simple as that. It's like in MotoGP when people were saying, well, why does Mika Kallio have a minus sign next to his number and a degree? Is that like a joke about you know, Finland and its cold weather? And people were trying to really in-depth think about this, like, why has he got a minus 36 degrees count as his front plate on his bike? And it turns out Mika just said, yeah, it is literally a joke about Finland's bad weather. There's nothing more to it than that.
Yeah, it's like, sometimes you really don't need to overthink things. It's just as simple as that.
Yeah, it really is an obvious joke. Just suck it up and have a quick laugh at it. Yeah, that's a thing. But, yeah, Buxton quitting Twitter. I expect to see him back sometime between now and March. Bank on it.
Yeah, it's like, if he's not back on Twitter by Australia,
I'll be stunned.
Yeah, I'd be stunned.
You're missing out on a lot of marketing there, having a 50,000 follower Twitter account with NBC Sports involved, basically. He's having that professional job there. I mean, that's a lot of easy clicks on anything that on the NBC side of Formula One coverage. So I don't see how that could possibly be a thing. It'd be almost like being professionally obligated to having an account at this point. Like, he'll be back by Australia, I'm sure of that. I'm certain of that. He can't help himself. He tweets too much.
Yeah, especially when it's like, he's lost a big following that he probably can't get back, because like, his biggest friends, his producer, Blair Sodden, like, she only has like less than 2,000 followers. Let me go look at his cameraman's account. It's like, he's not getting those followers back.
Yeah, that's going to be a thing. Bummer. But yeah, I think we've stalled for long enough here, Ken.
Oh god, I've been stalling.
It is time. Anyway, we are only delaying the inevitable here by talking about Ted Kravitz's video blog in life. And we can't ignore the pink elephant in the room for any longer. Now, before we start these top 10 lists, I just want to get a few things out of the way. One, we know driver lists are pointless. You don't need to tell us this. Okay? Like, in a sport where the car provides 75% of the success, we know ranking drivers is going to be next to literally impossible. We get that. This is for a laugh, and for your entertainment, okay? Let's just make that clear before anything else. We do not intend to piss people off with this. Maybe. And we both understand that doing this kind of thing is purely an entertainment thing. It's subjective. It's subject to change, of course, given the nature of Formula One and given the fact we've been doing this already for 65 years in the modern era now. So, you know, we know, okay, basically. So don't take this... like I'm going to go full Keith Olbermann here and say don't take this completely seriously and absolutely literally. We just call it the 10 best drivers in F1 history.
Yeah, it's like... Do not take my opinion as fact. Feel free to share my opinions without the express written consent of my Twitter account.
Yeah, please. Like, so, whatever you do, do not tweet at Ryan Eric King after this podcast goes live, okay?
Like, my opinions are not facts. They're opinions.
No, mine is, on the other hand, so... Oh, my God. And I'm... Feel free to direct all hate and criticism to ask.fm/Harrison101. No, I'm joking.
It's like, you have fun with that.
Oh, trust me, I do on many occasions already. At this point, I've just gone full heel turn on Twitter. It's going to be worse than a Roman Reigns Rumble win.
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah. I've just gone full heel at this point. I'm just going to embrace all forms of hate now on my page. And so, yeah, I say come at me, bro, if you don't like this list. So, I think how we're going to do this, I think we're going to go 10 up to 1. And I think we'll go one at a time through 10 first of all, right? Does that sound good?
Yeah, yeah.
I think that sounds good. So, do you want to go first?
Okay.
So you're number 10.
Can I just do 10 and 9 at the same? Because it's like, I really can't separate these two.
You got the disclaimer out of the way, so, you know, 10 and 9 are pretty much a coin flip at this point. And to be honest, for me... 10 through 7 is pretty much a coin flip as well for me. So, you know, this is almost in no particular order for the first few of these. So,
okay.
Yeah.
They're both 9 and 10. Joint 9 and 10. They're both...
Shut up. That's a cop-out and you know it, King.
They're both quintessential drivers of their era, the same era. They're both British. They're both two-time Formula One world champions. They're both Indianapolis 500 champions. They're Graham Hill and Jim Clark.
Wow. You had Graham Hill in your top 10.
Of course. He's the only driver to complete the Triple Crown of Motorsport, win Le Mans, win Monaco, and win the Indianapolis 500.
I'll be honest, like, Graham Hill was my number 11. I'll be dead straight with you on this one. Like, Graham Hill was the one name I could not do it. I just could not put him over my number 10. Mainly because this is an F1 list and not a motorsport list. But,
that's true. But, we're ranking how great the drivers are. You didn't say how great they are in Formula One.
It's true. I know. I remember. The funny thing I mentioned this is that I said I once got a famous Ask FM question saying, "Who do you think is how do you rank these British racing drivers?" And I remember famously having Hamilton below Graham Hill, and I got mocked for it. And I'm like, "Shut up!" Like, Graham Hill was a great driver who, you know, obviously again passed away before his career really ended, which is a shame. But you know, he's hit the one Triple Crown in terms of Le Mans, Indy, and then, you know, Formula One as well on top of that. So Graham Hill's a great pick. I'm never going to criticize anyone that has Graham Hill in the top 10. So that's fine by me. I know you had Clark at 9, so I guess I've got to play catch up here because you pretty much said that 10 and 9 are identical. You cheat. My 10 is Fernando Alonso.
Fernando Alonso, really?
Yeah, like, I can't ignore longevity on this one. Like, obviously Nando's won 2 world titles. He's got 32 career wins in under his belt. I think it's 32, I think I want to say. It's 30-something. I think it's over 32 or 33, something like that. And for all intents and purposes, he should probably have more than 2 titles to his name. He's been a runner-up on 3 separate occasions. I know one of them, he got blasted by Vettel in 2013. One of the time, he was like the best of the rest really for that season. But I think Alonso is a really, really great driver. And, you know, he's kind of earned the respect of his piece. He's like the people's champion for number one, if you're not British, essentially. Yeah. For obvious reasons. Disclaimer, Lewis Hamilton is not on this list. Suck it up.
he's not on my list either.
We're drunk with power. For me, it's Nando. And my attitude is, because of another driver on this list, I'd find it pretty hard not to include Fernando Alonso as well somewhere. So that was my logic, as to having Alonso at 10. Any comment on that, Gunn?
But, like, the thing is, why I didn't include Alonso, Clark and Hill are the two only double world champions I have on my list. And compared to Alonso, the only reason why they didn't win more world championships was outside their own fate, because Hill finished runner-up 3 times, and
that's true.
Clark finished runner-up. He finished runner-up once and third twice. The reason I say Alonso could have won more world champions, won more world titles, but Alonso really doesn't know how to lead a team. It's basically, the team basically have to hand him a good car to win. He can't develop a car.
And that's the only reason why I didn't have Alonso higher. Because, to be honest, it kind of goes hand in hand. If Alonso was a decent team leader, he'd have had more world titles and he'd be higher up in the list than 10. So I guess it kind of goes hand in hand, really. That's his major problem. His whole career has been pretty mismanaged, to say the least. Like, he won at Renault, and Renault was really, really good in 2005 and 6.
Yeah.
Went to McLaren. McLaren had a really good car that year. But I think he underestimated how good Lewis Hamilton was going to be right off the bat. Didn't like it. Screwed over the team, and then basically dropped out and then moved back to Renault. Renault was not the team it was in 2008. May or may not have rigged a race in his favour, basically. And, you know, Alonso...
May or may not, it happened. It happened.
Yeah, like, Alonso to this day claims he had no knowledge of what was going on. I call bullshit on that, personally.
The only reason why he has to plead innocence, because in a case like this, in race fixing, I'm pretty sure that's a lifetime ban for a driver.
Yeah, like, Nelson Piquet was blackballed after that one, so there's no way he'd be allowed back in F1 even now, obviously, even after his career ended in 2008, I think he was gone.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, essentially, that's the only reason why Alonso can be this, is because if it wasn't, his career would be over, basically, at that point and then. But I to this day still maintain Alonso was in on that, essentially. Then he went to Ferrari in 2010, and, you know, first season, you know, Alonso was handed everything he could to win at Ferrari, but it just didn't quite come through for him. 2010, he was too busy thinking about Mark Webber to worry about Vitaly Petrov in front of him, which was a problem. In 2012, people always say the Ferrari in 2012 was bad. Like, people, it won 4 races that year. Like there's no bad car wins 4 Grand Prix a year.
If that, like, if that's the point to one specific season why I didn't include Fernando Alonso, it's 2012.
2012, he should have won the title, in my opinion.
Yes.
Like, he had a 40-point lead halfway through the season. Like, he was the one consistent thing about a otherwise very inconsistent first half of that season, where we had 7 different winners in the first 7 races from 6 different teams. So, you know, it was a bit up in the air, but Alonso was the one consistent guy throughout that time, and he had like a 40-50-point championship lead at the halfway point in that season, and somehow blew it. I know the crashes in Japan and Belgium didn't help, but come on, he should have won that title. And Ferrari, that in my opinion, that year was just as good. My argument I've always used is that Red Bull beat Ferrari in the Constructors by 60 points that year, 460 to 400. 57 of those 60 points came as a result of Felipe Massa losing out to Mark Webber. And we all know during that period, Webber was much better and in a better car, in my opinion, or at least made better use of the Red Bull than Massa did at Ferrari. So in my opinion, at least, if Ferrari had a decent second driver, they probably would have pinched the Constructors off of Red Bull during that 4-year spell of dominance.
Yeah, but they felt obligated to Felipe, so they couldn't get rid of him.
Rubbish. They could have easily
they could have easily got rid of him.
And I think it would have been understandable given his condition, and I think the 4 years afterwards kind of justified that, but hey, to each their own. So, moving on to number nine. My number nine, because I know you already mentioned Clark,
yep.
I have Clark a little bit higher on my list, funnily enough. I have Sir Jack Brabham at nine.
Ooh, I have Brabham higher.
Okay, that's interesting. I have Brabham at nine. Obviously, kind of goes without saying, triple world champion, built his team from the ground up, raced in it, won with it. It's like the ultimate dream F1 story, really, isn't it?
He's also like, oh, I don't know if he's the only, but I know he's one of the very few drivers to actually win Formula One Grand Prix in three separate decades.
Did he really?
Yeah, he won in the 50s at the start of his career, and he ended up winning in the 60s, obviously, and in the 70s at the end of his career.
Huh. I did not know that. That's pretty neat. That is pretty neat. I'm trying to think of it through in my head, and I can't think of anyone else off the top of my head who's won in three different decades. A lot of them have won in two, but not three. That's a pretty neat stat. I did not realise that. But yeah, for me, Sir Jack Brabham, you know, obviously rest in peace. We lost him last year, which was just all the more tragic, really. I think at least he had a good knock. I think he was 88, I think he was when he died. He had a good knock, you know. He had a good innings, as we English folks say, over cricket. For me, yeah, Sir Jack at number nine. Like I said before, my 7 to 10 is very, very close. So, you know, if anyone wants to disagree with me on that and have him a little bit higher, I won't blame you. I could have very well easily done the same thing. So, yeah, Sir Jack at nine. He may not be the only Sir Jack on this list. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. So, King, you're number eight.
My number eight? The charismatic, the Austrian, Niki Lauda.
You have Lauda at eight?
Yeah, I have Lauda at eight.
Okay. That's interesting. I have Lauda higher than that. So, we'll get to that later on down the road. So, why Niki at eight for you?
Oh, I mean, why? I don't know. The guys have a higher. I just hold them in more highly of a regard, but the reason why I put him on the list, obviously, three-time world champion.
Indeed.
He has a massive gap between his first championship and his last championship.
Yeah.
His first championship in 1975 and his last championship in 1984.
Yeah, like nearly a decade between titles. Yeah, I mean, Lauda was, like, I think Lauda's on the list of oldest world champions as well. I think he won his last one when he was like 35 or whatnot, which you just don't get anymore these days, really.
Yeah, I think only Fangio's older, probably.
I think Fangio, and I think Damon Hill may have been a little bit older when he won his. I think Hill was 35, 36 as well. I'm not 100% sure on that one. That's one for Wikipedia. yeah, like, Niki, you know, the story of Rush, I know, will capture the hearts of a lot of people. I know it did for me when I watched it, and obviously having a little bit more of an understanding of what Niki had to go through after the, obviously, the horrific Nürburgring fire and whatnot. But the fact he was able to be so good for so long as well, and be able to persevere, come through, win in a different car and whatnot as well, and, you know, it's clear the driver was, you know, was a bigger influence back then, I think, as well. So, actually, for that reason, I've Lauda a little bit higher. So, I'll cover that later. But, yeah, more than a solid pick. Maybe a little bit harsh on Lauda, funnily enough. Therefore, I'd say that. Yeah, Lauda at 8, that's pretty fair. For me, it's the other Sir Jack. In this case, it's a Jackie. It's a Jackie Stewart for me at 8, personally.
Yeah, I have Jackie higher.
Okay, interesting enough. So Jackie won very... He's got an excellent win rate, obviously triple world champion. And I hold him a little bit close because he did so much to try and improve driver safety as well. And that's always something that's been very passionate of mine as well. So it's a little bit of a personal thing with me for Sir Jackie as well to have him up at the 8th slot. But didn't he win like 27 times in just 99 races?
Yeah, like during
that's pretty insane.
Yeah, during a certain period of his career, his win rate was probably unmatched.
Yeah, that's pretty insane. Just in terms of, I know obviously when it comes to F1, you kind of got to luck in a little bit when it comes to, you know, good cars at the right times to, you know, really be successful and whatnot. But that's a pretty insane win rate now you look at it.
Yeah, like, I'm probably going to mention it before. It's going to heavily factor into who I pick as number one. Well, win rate is really important to me, especially since the length of the season's changed so frequently. Being able to win constantly is important.
Indeed, and obviously seasons now are obviously much bigger than they were back then. I mean, even like back then it was 14, 15 race seasons. Now we're at 19, 20, and you know we were going to have a 21 race season this year. Maybe 20, but looks a lot more likely. I don't think we're going to South Africa this year. As much as Bernie's going to try and push for that, because you know, because he's Bernie. for me, Sir Jackie, it's a very an iconic driver. He had a tartan, and you know, and obviously representing Scotland, and just a great driver, just a great, great driver. And you know, I he was one of the first guys I watched on DVD when I was looking up older F1 drivers. I was like, Sir Jackie was awesome.
Yeah, I think like Formula 1 is definitely a whole different place because of Jackie Stewart, because I know at the beginning of his career that no circuit had Armco barriers at all by 1972. Yeah. Every circuit had to have them.
Yeah, so you know, as much as you may not want to praise Sir Jackie the driver, as much, and I know a lot of people do, so that's not really a thing to worry about. He's an iconic name in terms of the sport and you know where the sport is today more than anything else. So for that reason alone, I think I've got to have Sir Jackie at number eight. Did we say you're eight, King, already?
Yeah, I had Lauda.
So you had Lauda at 8, I had Stewart at 8. So what's your 7?
7, I had... Oh, that's where I put Jack Brabham.
Ah, so you have Brabham at 7 then. Yeah, okay, Brabham at 7.
Like,
so you have him a little bit higher than me.
Going to my notes, like, his first victory was... Oh, yeah, his first victory was in his first championship season. That's what he got his first victory, his first championship season. The 1959 Monaco Grand Prix... was his first was his first victory, and his last victory was the 1970 South African Grand Prix, which is also the first race of that season.
How about that? 1959 and 70 were his wins were.
Yes.
They're dotted out over that period of the 60s, obviously, where he had obviously the vast majority of his success. But yeah, so it looks like Brabham a little bit higher than me, so yeah, that kind of makes sense. Again, no problem with that whatsoever.
And the fact,
I'm not going to question that at all.
He'll probably be the last world champion to win. To win a world championship in a car of their own design, because we're not going to see an engineer driver anytime soon.
No, that's just not how the sport is these days anymore. I know Nico Rosberg's got a degree in engineering, but I don't think he'd take it that far.
No. I'm pretty sure Paddy Lowe's not going to be like, yeah, Nico, take a look at this.
Yeah, like, Nico, what do you reckon about this? Do you think it's going to give us enough downforce next year? No? I know Rosberg's a very clever man, but I don't think he's that clever. yeah, absolutely. I don't see that ever being topped in terms of a guy of his own design winning a championship. It's the dream story, really. You know, it's like, did you ever see the third series of Tuned by McLaren?
Yeah.
Yeah, and how it starts with Bruce McLaren, basically, and he keeps coming up with car designs in his own garage, his own little shed in New Zealand somewhere. It reminds me of that to a degree. That's the Oscar-winning team, by the way, behind that, because I think they got an Oscar for Best Visual Effects for Gravity, so yeah, I think that's Framestore there, so yeah, much love to those guys. That's what it just reminds me of. It just reminds me of Bruce and all the different designs coming out of his shed.
Yeah, that's what the 60s were, a bunch of guys moving to Britain, designing cars and sheds, and Enzo Ferrari hated it.
Yeah, it's like Enzo's not about this life.
he's about factories, not sheds.
Yeah, he's about that factory life. Like we're, a Ferrari, we do things differently. But my number 7 was indeed Jim Clark. I had Clark a little bit higher than you on this one, funnily enough. But didn't Clark die at like 32?
Yeah, he died at 32 in a Formula 2 race at Hockenheim.
Yeah, of all things. Like, Jim, what were you doing?
I mean, that was pretty much a common thing at the time. That's how you get more experience at the track. You decide to just hop in the Formula 2 race. I mean, it's still commonplace today in NASCAR where guys get in the second division race to get more track experience.
Mm. But, yeah, just tragic with Jim Clark. I've always said that I think Clark's the best British driver of all time in my book, so as you can probably have guessed, there's no other Brits on this list. well, not on my list anyway. I don't know if King's any more on his. I don't think he does.
No,
I'd be surprised if he did, but no. For me, Clark's the best British driver ever. Had an incredible win rate. Was, you know, obviously double world champion. I think could have achieved a lot more. I think if it wasn't for that tragic Formula 2 race at Hockenheim. And for me, I think he's my number 7, and just another one of those iconic drivers, really, that, you know, just defined an era, I'd say, so to speak. For me, you know, Clark's at 7. Into what I think is going to be the nitty-gritty now. I think the meat of this list is going to come up real soon now, because I think this is going to be the interesting era. Like, 5 to 8, I think, is going to be interesting. So for you, who's your number 6, Ryan?
Jackie Stewart.
Oh, you had Jackie as high as 6?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, I mean, that works.
Yeah, I had Jackie Stewart mainly for safety. When I think safety, I think 1970, I think 1972, 1973, and obviously 1994.
Yeah, because didn't his teammate, obviously, Francois Sivert, die as well when it was just in the middle of promoting safety as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, and he decided to basically retire from the sport in his prime.
Indeed, I think there was a lot more that could have been done with Jackie, but you know, he was so adamant on his beliefs about safety and whatnot that you know, essentially he retired when he was in his prime. So,
he retired a world champion.
Yeah, that doesn't happen very often, does it?
Yeah, it's like 3 world championships in 5 years and just retire.
Yeah, that's pretty insane when you look at it like that. So yeah, absolutely, got no problems with Jackie at 6. My number 6 was a guy again already mentioned earlier, Niki Lauda, for me. Pretty much for the same reasons that you mentioned, Ryan, as well. Just the longevity of his greatness, you know, what he was able to do with Ferrari. You know, and again, just the iconicness of his story in terms of, you know, his legacy and what he's left behind, and he's still being the crazy old man now on the F1 paddock in his 70s with the cap still. It's just, you know, I Lauda's one of my favorite drivers ever. I've always said that. So there's going to be an element of bias in this. I don't really care.
And the thing is, like, so, Ferrari at the time where Niki Lauda showed up was going through a period pretty similar to the period Ferrari's going through now. They haven't won a world championship in a decade. The last world championship that was won at Ferrari before Niki Lauda showed up was by John Surtees in 1964. And
yeah, a decade, basically.
This is the season where Enzo finally decided to step down. Luca de Montezemolo steps up as team principal, and he signs...
Ooh, him?
Yes, yes, him. And he gets Niki Lauda to drive the car.
Somehow I think Luca knew what he was doing all those times at Ferrari. Most of the time, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, Luca basically gave Niki full reign. Niki got to pick who his teammate was. Niki got to choose how the car was set up. Niki basically ran the thing. Luca financed it.
And it worked in the end, really. Well, most of the time, anyway. But if it wasn't for a bit of an upsetting fire. Because let's be real here, people. James Hunt probably shouldn't have gotten that world title. You know, but that's another thing people are going to get mad at me about, because people seem to think James Hunt was this godly driver when he was just a bit of a flash in the pan more than anything else.
No, it was more of Ferrari not being able to remove that British thorn from their side all the way.
Yeah, it's like, can we just get rid of that bastard blonde-haired fool Hunt?
It's like, we dealt with Tyrrell, we dealt with Lotus, now can we please get McLaren out of the way?
Yeah, it's like, no, because McLaren were going to go with Jackie X, and then James Hunt obviously got the seat instead, and we all know how well that one turned out for Hunt in the end. You know, win, epic story, beats a guy who missed half the season. Hooray for him. I'm going to shag like 15,000
people now. Oh,
we've all seen the movie, and I'm jealous that Chris Hemsworth got to bang Natalie Dormer in the first 5 minutes of that damn film.
Everyone is.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. But yeah, for me, for me, Nikki's at 6. So, you know, again, I don't have a problem with the Stewart pick at 6 either. So, into the top 5, the nitty gritty, and I think this is going to be where
it's going to get controversial.
I think the order is going to be interesting. I think I know who 4 of the 5 are going to be. I'm just not sure of the order. I think that's going to be more intriguing. So, who's your 5, Ryan?
Number 5, Ayrton Senna.
What? Wow! Did you just say what I thought you just said?
Yes. I said Ayrton Senna, number 5.
We're going to die. We're going to die. It's been nice knowing you, people. King had Senna at 5. We're all going to die a painful death. It's been fun. I'm going to put Kendrick owning everything in my will. Okay. Before we die, at least let's provide some context on our gravestones. So, why Senna at 5, King?
Number 1, he won all his world championships at one team. He won all of them at McLaren. I mean, I'm not saying that's a fault against him, but that's a sign of what a driver's working with. Yes, he was a great driver, and he could have achieved more, but we're not going to go on what-ifs here.
Ooh, okay. So yeah, we're gonna take the lost potential factor out of the equation here.
Like, he did have a great season in 1987 at Lotus, where he ended up finishing 3rd in the championship. But for the most part, Senna has always been, I mean, in NASCAR terms, they call it checkers or wreckers. He's either gonna win the race or put it in the wall trying.
Yeah, that was like, don't get me wrong, like, I don't value Senna as highly as other people do, even though a lot of people swear by having Senna as the greatest ever. I don't, I never have, and I never will, personally, and you'll probably see why when it comes to my top 4, and probably where he ends up. Spoiler alert. But, yeah, like, I've never gotten over Senna's recklessness and the fact he nearly killed Alan Prost in that incident in Japan.
And the famous quote that came after that incident where he tried to kill a driver is probably one of the most revered quotes in Formula One. You're no longer a racing driver if a gap exists and you still go for it. And I was like, no! That is just that's a flat out lie you just told everyone. You drove into a disappearing wedge straight into Alan Prost.
I don't care what anyone says, Senna did that on purpose, and if he did that today, he'd be vilified for it. Like, look what happened when Nicholas Prost had that crash of Heinfeld in Formula E, and people who don't even watch Formula E was pouring abuse at Nicholas Prost that day. Like, imagine if that happened in Formula One with a guy like him, and he came out and said that afterwards.
Like,
the internet would go into meltdown.
If Senna were racing today, he would be hated, not revered.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I've never been able to get over that one personally. So for me, like, Senna's recklessness, I think, because the thing is, I've always said, like, Top Gear segment on this is always, I think, one of my favorites on Ayrton Senna, because it covers all sides of the spectrum. It's not just a blowjob towards Ayrton, like the film Senna was, which, you know, the proof that film was a blowjob was essentially because they had an hour worth of Alan Prost interviews that didn't make the final cut, but they put it on the extended version.
It's like, oh, we have to cut it for time. What do we cut first, guys?
Oh, yeah, all the Alan Prost interview coverage.
And even the director, Cavadia, he even mentioned, like, the film's called Senna for a reason, guys.
Yeah, like, so I can understand why he was, but that doesn't tell you the full story. And, you know, Top Gears did cover the full spectrum. They were talking with Martin Brundle during the whole thing. And he talked about how Senna was essentially ridiculously reckless, and he was going to always put his car in a position where he would make you choose whether to have the accidents or not.
And it's like,
that is terrifying.
It's either choose to just end both of your races or just yield him the position.
Is that really a healthy mantra for Formula One drivers of the future? Really? either I'm going to make you have an accident now. give me the place or crash. And it's like, that, I'm not sure that's a healthy way of thinking. But they also mentioned how weird it was and how a bit of a hypocrite he was, in the sense of he would run you off the road and kill you to have that position or to win a championship. But if somebody else crashed, he'd be the first guy out of the car to send for help. Like, just bizarre. Like, he had a very bizarre mindset. And I've never been able to get over that for me. So for me, yeah, I don't have him as high as many people love, but you're him at 5. Like, even so, he has a ridiculous set of numbers, like the greatest qualifier of all time, probably.
I mean, when it comes to total number of pole positions, he is the greatest qualifier of all time. When it comes to pole rate, when it comes to how many qualifying sessions you're able to come out with pole, he isn't number one. The guy who I have as number one does.
Interesting. We'll get to that later. But, yeah.
But without a doubt, Ayrton Senna is blindingly fast, and I don't ignore that fact.
No, like, in my opinion, he's probably the most naturally gifted driver I've ever seen, for what it's worth.
Yeah.
Like, as a guy that you feel was probably put on this planet to race, yeah, it was probably Ayrton Senna. Is he the greatest? No. Is he the most iconic? Probably. So, you know, when people think of F1, they think of a guy like Ayrton Senna. And, like, even my mother knew who Ayrton Senna was, and she's never been an F1 fan like I am. And even she was rocked to the core when Senna died in 94. So, you know, he was one of the very few guys that's able to transcend their own sport in terms of popularity. A Roger Federer, a Valentino Rossi.
Well, I don't know.
Someone like that.
I really have to put it to the time he was popular, because that's when the individual rose, because Senna's era was also the same era as Michael Jordan.
Yeah, Michael Jordan, yeah, you know, he was becoming a feud star in basketball, and yeah, that's a fair point. You know, maybe there is just the era of, you know, the nature of the sport at the time.
Yeah.
But I still think that happens now to a degree as well.
I mean,
you know, the last decade with guys like Roger Federer and, you know, Valentino Rossi and a David Beckham, so to speak, as well, for instance.
I mean, it happened, you know? But it started then, because that was the first era of, you know, big time commercialization, where you had athletes as spokesmen, and Senna was avid as being a spokesman to earn extra money on the side. Also, you know, Michael Jordan with Nike. Well, in the United States, it was mainly centered around Nike, where you had Michael Jordan, you had Bo Jackson.
So yeah, that's a fair point as well. I didn't look like that. There's a lot of commercials, a lot of advertising, a lot of, you know, big money sponsorships and endorsements and whatnot. Like, if you've ever seen the ESPN documentary Broke, as part of their 30 for 30 series, you'll see what I mean on this one. I highly recommend it. It's actually a very eye-opening watch if you don't understand just how crazy money in sport can get sometimes.
Yeah,
and how one out of athletes will spend it. It's eye-opening.
And I'd also add the other 30 for 30 piece. I think it's Say It Ain't Bo, or their piece on Bo Jackson, how basically anecdotes and the commercials he was in basically made the myth greater than the man.
Interesting. I'll have to find that and give that a watch one point. Yeah. I've not seen that one yet. Is that part of the more recent one? Because it's on my list of ones to watch. I want to see Rand University, because I know Bomani Jones produced that, and it was one of my favorite
journalists. Yeah, I watched Rand University. It is an excellent documentary about, you know, Randy Moss, West Virginia in general. As someone who's in Western Pennsylvania and goes to the University of Pittsburgh, we have a fierce rival with West Virginia, despite West Virginia being probably the poorest part of the United States.
Yeesh. So yeah, I want to check that one out. So yeah, if you've got the American Netflix, you're listening from America, I think they're all pretty much on there. I think there's a fair few on YouTube as well, if you're willing to look. I don't think ESPN are that strict about their copyright, thank God. So there's a few on there as well. But yeah, a lot of the series are really good, and there's a couple recommendations there for you if you're into your American sport or just sport in general, because a lot of them are very well made. My number five is Sebastian Vettel.
Ooh, I have Vettel higher.
Good.
Vettel higher.
We're gonna die. We're gonna die. I have Vettel in my top five. Like, in the era of the open internet, for me to say Sebastian Vettel is the fifth best driver of all time, I might get executed tomorrow. Like, if I don't tweet tomorrow, you know what's happened to me. Like, somebody wearing a Hamilton jumpsuit has attacked me in the night and stabbed me. Sebastian Vettel, if he retired tomorrow, he'd be a top five driver of all time, in my opinion. His numbers are outrageous for what he's done for a guy who's still only 27 and is only in his, what, eight? He's done eight full seasons now, I think?
Yeah.
07 to 08. He's done eight full seasons and he's won four. That's a 50% championship rate in seasons he's been in Formula One.
He's only had one mediocre season so far, and that's average compared to the other seasons he's been in. Every season he's driven in, he's been spectacular. He's been spectacular. He hasn't put a foot wrong.
Yeah, like, this is the first year that Vettel's even had a mediocre year. Hamilton's had, like, four of them. Like, to put that into contrast, like, Hamilton's had, like, four seasons where McLaren was still decent enough to win races, but weren't consistent enough to be able to be in title contention. Like, if you look at Hamilton's title history, it's, like, fourth again, like, after that he won his title in 2008. That was a long, dry spell of major success for Lewis, despite winning the occasional race. I think that's what kept him relevant more than anything else. But for me, Vettel is a monster. You know, 39 career wins puts him third all time. I mean, he's probably going to surpass Senna if Ferrari have any ideas about that. And they probably will, because Ferrari are never out of the spotlight for very long when it comes to Formula One. So I think they'll get there eventually. Yeah. And I'm cautiously optimistic about that, I would say. Vettel won four consecutive championships. That's something that I think only Schumacher and Fangio was done, I think.
I'm not exactly sure about Fangio. I know Schumacher has done it.
Of course, yeah. Schumacher obviously had the five consecutive, but yeah, obviously winning four straight championships. And contrary to popular belief, that Red Bull wasn't quite as amazing for two of those 4 years, yeah, quite frankly.
To be honest, like, let me just do a rundown of his career. First season in Formula One, youngest point scorer for BMW Sauber in his first race. In his first race, he scored points. Then he,
as a 19-year-old,
then he finishes the season at Toro Rosso and scores points again next year, 2008. Obviously, he wins a Grand Prix in a Toro Rosso.
Yeah, that was a Minardi for all intents and purposes. Like, that is an outrageous. And you know what? It wasn't a fluke, because he was in the top six like almost every other race that season. Including the fourth in China as well, which was another great result for him as well.
Yeah, I don't think Toro has had a season that great ever since.
No, never. Not even
2009,
close.
His rookie season at Red Bull has four race wins. Daniel Ricciardo didn't do that. And finished second in the championship.
Yeah, if it wasn't for Jenson Button's broken car, he could have easily had a fifth championship. Because by the time he got to Monaco, the season was already over.
Yeah.
And Vettel was the best of the rest that year, and people forget he was a runner-up in 2009 as well.
Yeah, and then obviously you have his four championship seasons, and that, it speaks for itself.
Yeah, 35 wins in those four seasons. 35 wins, over 40 pole positions. Like I said, you got to remember, this is a guy that's only done eight full seasons. His career is outrageous to this point. He could retire tomorrow and he'd be one of the greatest drivers ever. And you know what? I think it's because he's not popular and that he's not a sexy driver like Hamilton, you know, who has the spectacular overtakes now and again, or isn't like Alonso, who wears fancy tattoos and quotes really dumb shit on Twitter now and again. Like motivational quotes and pretends he's a samurai or some
and
shit.
And he's not a checkers or wreckers guy like Senna, where I'm pretty sure if Vettel knows he can't win a race, he'll settle for where he is, like Alain Prost.
Yeah, he's a point scorer. He's a point stuffer. And in the sense of, you know, if he's not going to go for it, he's not going to take any gambles. He's an intelligent driver where that's concerned. You know, one of the best front runners we've ever seen in Formula One as well. If you give him a pole position and you give him the chance to win from pole, more often than not, he takes it. Very rare does he not do that as well. And that's an ability many people forget about as well. Like sometimes, on his day, he was absolutely invincible in that car. It was an unbeatable combination. Like, the nine straight wins in the second half of 2013 is as good a feat as you'll ever see in this sport, quite frankly. That was insane, quite frankly. And the last guy who won nine straight, was that Ascari, I think, back in the 50s?
Yeah, I think so.
Jesus Christ. But yeah, like I said, he is the statistical enigma for that very reason. You know, he's not really a part of this modern era of, you know, more socially friendly and, you know, more out there drivers where you can look into their psyches. He was one of only two drivers that isn't on Twitter on the current field. I think Kimi Raikkonen is the other one. And I think that's what makes it that much more appealing. And I think overall, I think he's not going to get the true credit he deserves until he retires.
Yeah, and based on the other guy I have higher than him on this list, usually that praise doesn't even come after you retire.
Yeah, what's the best way of putting it? The unsung hero, basically, so to speak. I don't think people are going to realize just how good Vettel was until he retired.
Especially, I basically call it getting prosted.
Yeah, getting prosted. That's a good way of saying it. Yeah, and you know, I don't think he'll ever get true credit for what it's worth. Maybe even after he retires, and I think that's partly because of the golden era we're now in Formula One, where 2012 we had 6 world champions on the grid, which had never been a thing before.
Yeah.
You know, and you know he beat Raikkonen, Alonso, Hamilton, Button, and Schumacher all at the same time. and 2012 was a very competitive season that year. The most competitive we've had in many years, I'd say.
It's like it almost seemed like Schumacher was going to win a Grand Prix in 2012.
Yeah, exactly. Like, they were all up there at one point or another. Like, Mercedes finally showed a little bit of pace that season as well. So it was definitely a season where it was all to play for. Williams even had pace on a couple of occasions. Like, I know it doesn't seem so surprising now, but 2 years ago, Williams sucked.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was made it all the more surprising. So for me, Vettel at 5, dare I say, is he your 4, or do you have him even higher than
that? He's my 4.
He's your 4. So, reasons for your 4, just to follow on from what we've
said. Pretty much what I said, he hasn't put a foot wrong. I'd probably call 2012 the season of champions, and he's the one who came out the victor in the season of champions.
If you ever want a pound-for-pound measure of how good a season that was, there's your answer right there. And he, not to mention, he pulled out 2 of the best drives of the modern era in Abu Dhabi and Brazil to win said championship as well. Abu Dhabi was an outrageous performance to get third. Apparently Fernando Alonso was shell-shocked when he saw the Red Bull behind him.
Like, I still remember that camera shot of him outside the car just staring into the void.
Brazil 2012 was like, what have I got to do to beat this man? Just the stare, and like, it's an iconic picture. It's just like, yeah, it ain't happening, Nando. It just ain't happening. But yeah, Vel, he's my 5. He's Ryan's 4. I was like, is he better than Senna? And I'm like, no, Dre, you can't do that. No, I couldn't quite put him above Ayrton.
Go with your head. Yet. Don't go with the crowd.
I can't do it. I can't do it just yet. But one more really good season from Seb, and I'd be very, very seriously considering putting him above Ayrton Senna. It's like, let's put it this way, 4 and 5 is a lot closer than people think, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And I said it before, I said, hey, after the end of the 2013 season, I said, I know he's probably going to pass Vettel's 40, or pass Senna's 41 wins at a certain point. And I said before, I said, the gap between them is a lot smaller than you guys think, and people didn't like it when I said that. But I think, seriously, go home, think about it, listen to this show, have a good think to yourself, and I think you'll realize the differences between Senna and Vettel are much, much smaller than you realize.
I mean, a lot of people use the eyeball test for Formula One, and it doesn't really work because the sport looks completely different.
Yeah, it's not the same sport that it was 20 years ago now. So, you know, it's you can't really use that logic. The eyeball test doesn't really work. And I'll say this, there isn't really a specific pound-for-pound method that's going to work above anything else. It's just subjectiveness more than anything else and what you think a great driver is. But, like, the eyeball test, come on. Like, no. F1 is a sport that changes every 5 years. Like, you can't really say that, you know, the eyeball test is effective because you know, car performance can swing on a dime year to year. I mean, look at Mercedes. They could dominate the next 2 or 3 years. Hamilton could end up with 5 titles. And it's like, well, Hamilton's now the greatest of the modern era.
Yeah, I mean, on my list, he definitely... Things would definitely change if he just suddenly saw success. Because I'm... My subjective terms is basically I just use achievement more than anything else.
Yeah. I've always said it. Achievements and stats are probably the best baseline you can go off in this, in something like this. Because anything else opens yourself to a lot more potential criticism. So, yeah, who's your four? You said your four was Vettel. I've got to give you my four. My four was indeed Ayrton Senna. So, again, similar reasons we mentioned earlier. We discussed Senna at length already. So, who's your three?
Alain Prost. Yep.
We'll get it off the record. He's my number three as well. So
We both have him at three.
We both have him at three. Prost is a monster. And he was one of the best drivers ever. There's no doubt about that. Just longevity of success, the fact he was able to bring success in different cars, his intelligence, his calculated nature. I mean, there's a reason they call him the professor. And just overall, his career is just magnificent.
And his career could have been... I mean, I don't use could have been often, but it's like so margin... Like so... If it wasn't for Senna, his career would have been... Michael Schumacher wouldn't have out-topped him.
We wouldn't have been ridiculous if it wasn't for Senna.
Prost was 4 times a champion with Senna, and also 4 times a bridesmaid. Imagine if you converted some of those second places to a championship.
Indeed. It's like, didn't he miss out 1 year by 0.5 point?
Yeah, to Niki Lauda.
Yeah, 0.5 point. And Prost would have had 5, and then we would have had a very different conversation. But for me, Prost is just he's one of my favorite drivers ever, just because he's just that good. You know, he's just so good and for so long, and with so many different cars. There's not one distinctive Prost era, in my opinion. It's just a magnificent career, more than anything else.
I don't know why, but most people associate the first turbo era with Ayrton Senna, even though Ayrton Senna didn't see most of his success until after turbochargers were banned.
Exactly. It's like, Prost really is the more defining guy for that era, more than anything else.
Yeah, he was the guy at McLaren during the turbo era. Ayrton Senna just happened to win a couple races in a Lotus, then decide to jump to McLaren and become the number two guy until 1988.
Exactly. So, you know, Prost's career is just magnificent. You know, like you said, 4 world titles, 4 times a runner up is just ridiculous. On top of that as well, 51 race victories, second all time only to Michael, and we all know Michael is a monster when it comes to stats. A freak when more than anything else. And I'm going to go out on a limb and guess he's your number two as well.
Yeah, but, I mean, back to Prost, like, why people rate Senna over Prost? Well, Alain Prost was not liked throughout his entire career, because the first time he finished runner-up in a Renault, he decided to jump ship to McLaren, and literally factory workers at Renault torched his Mercedes-Benz at his home.
Wow! That I did not know! Holy shit! Wow, I'm guessing Renault wasn't best pleased about the whole thing.
No, people were not pleased that he decided to leave to McLaren.
Well, I've always said it, Senna's always getting more popular because Senna's the sexy pick, you know, in the terms of, you know, he was the guy that was, you know, flamboyant, exciting, and... You know, whatnot. But while Prost was more quiet and calculating and may not necessarily have been liked, but he was clever. And, you know, people don't, like, smart isn't sexy most of the time. I would know. Like, like, smart isn't sexy, unfortunately. It's not, like, the racing driver, you know, stereotype mantra of being clever and being shrewd. It's more about, you know, being fast and being excited and being Ayrton Senna and having the big chest out and, you know, the chest hairs, the grizzled look and, the, you know, the passion.
Even though I would not describe any driver in my top three that way.
No, funnily enough. And, So let's move on. Number two, Michael Schumacher.
Yep, Michael Schumacher.
my number two as well, Michael Schumacher. And yeah, if there's ever a driver that describes the early 2000s and the late 90s and is just, you know, of all the Ferrari's had almost every great driver through their doors at some point or another. And who would have thought Michael Schumacher would stand out the most? And for good reason. I mean, that era of Ferrari is just as iconic as it gets. Especially for a guy like my age, who's 22, and I know you all think you're 21 as well.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, just... I started watching Formula 1 in, like, 1999, I think. That was the year Schumacher broke both his legs at Silverstone, and Eddie Irvine had the shot, but... That golden era of Ferrari from 2000 to 2004 is just untouchable, really. I don't think we might not. I mean, we said that with Hamilton now, but and with Mercedes and where they are, but at the time, I was thinking we may not ever see something like this again.
Yeah, even most people now don't think we're going to see something like that again. Like, Bernie Ecclestone says Mercedes is probably going to be dominant for the next two seasons. That's not 5 years. That's 3 years.
That's not five. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, 91 race wins. That's never getting beaten, in my opinion.
No. Unless Formula One somehow decides to go to 40 race seasons. We're not seeing that.
No. I mean, work it out like this. If you have a 20-year career, you've got to average 4.5 race wins a year. At 20 seasons to get to 91. That's never happening again in this era. The field's too competitive these days.
And the gap between first and second is so massive between him and Ayrton Senna.
Yeah, it's not even close. For me, Schumacher, like, more than anything else, the last 30 years or so, like, if you could put together a Frankenstein's monster of all the great factors of an F1 driver and have a guy who rewrote the rule book, it was Michael Schumacher.
I mean, Michael Schumacher's late 90s, early 2000s Ferrari was just all the staff from the early 90s Benetton with Ferrari's budget.
Yeah, imagine that. Obviously, Benetton, obviously in 94 and 95 when Schumacher won his first two, that was a great team, and a team that really did push the envelope in terms of F1 technology. I mean, there was the traction control talk and the suspension talk of Benetton that, you know, people were envious of that team, and people were sure they were cheating.
We don't know for sure because they never handed in their computer data, but people are very suspicious.
They're very suspicious, and you know, Benetton was a team that really did, you know, push the envelope forward, and you know, Schumacher was the on the crest of the wave from that, from 94 and 95, and it took him a little while to get there with Ferrari, but he got there in the end, and by God, I mean, imagine Benetton with money, and that was pretty much Ferrari point, and that's a terrifying combination.
It was basically the dream team of Michael Schumacher, Ross Brawn, and the only person that could ever rival Adrian Newey, Rory Byrne.
Exactly. Just a ridiculous combination, and just iconic in terms of, I mean, and, you know, this is a guy who did break the rules. He did cheat Schumacher. You know, I still say the Adelaide crash was on purpose. I don't care what anyone tells me.
Yeah, that was on purpose.
He obviously, you know, the tap on Jacques Villeneuve and the famous Martin Brundle call of, you've hit him in the wrong place this time, Michael.
But the thing is, what separates Schumacher from Senna? Because I know people are probably going to argue this. They're like, oh, Senna crashed people. Schumacher crashed people too. It's like, no, Schumacher did crash people. But it was only when the championship was on the line. Besides that, he was pretty much just cool, calm, and calculated.
And that's the whole point. Calculated. Michael Schumacher rode that fine line with the rules on many occasions. Senna took two rocket boosters and just flew over that line when he crashed into Alan Prost all those years ago. Like, it's a different ball game entirely where that's concerned. Schumacher was more the guy that rode the line more than anything else.
Yeah, the thing is, like, that got Schumacher disqualified in 97.
Indeed, and you know, you took it too far against Jacques, basically, and you know, that broken BAR that even then Jacques took, made a dog's dinner to try and win that championship in, more than anything else. But just in terms of just sheer legacy, I don't think Schumacher's ever going to get beaten statistically for his career and whatnot, and his achievements are just out of this world. You know, many things he's done will not be beaten, in my opinion, and just that iconic part of Formula One where I started watching the early 2000s and just him in the scarlet red, and all I can remember is just him winning everything.
And the thing is, like, on the all-time win list, Schumacher, 91, Alan Prost, 51, Ayrton Senna, 41, next active driver in fourth place, Vettel, 39.
Yeah, he has one less win than Senna and Prost combined. who on my list is 3 and 4, and is on your list 3 and 5.
Yeah.
That's no short company. That's two of the best ever. And yeah, Schumacher, obviously, keep fighting, Michael. We're all behind you. We're never going to forget just how ridiculous a driver you were, even in the Mercedes era when he came back. And the flashes of brilliance, like in Valencia, he got on the podium, and that iconic pole lap at Monaco, which stunned the world.
Yeah, that was his swan song. That was his way to say goodbye to Formula One, because he knew that was going to be his last season.
Yeah, that was very special, and I still watch it to this day, and I think, God damn, what a legend! I remember as a YouTuber as well, seeing X Manny G, who is a huge Schumacher fan. He nearly wet himself that day on Twitter when Schumacher was on pole. I swear to God, a little bit of pee may have came out, because it was special, very very special indeed. So yeah, that only leaves that number one, and I'm pretty sure I'm right in saying it's Juan Manuel Fangio, right?
El Maestro Juan Manuel Fangio.
And you know what? When you've won nearly half the Grand Prix you've ever entered...
When you've got on pole half the Grand Prix you ever entered...
And with 4 different cars as well.
You're the oldest world champion. Your career started in your 30s.
There will never be a Fangio ever, ever again. Never, ever, ever will there be another Fangio again in this sport.
It's like, on paper, he may not seem that impressive... But the fact, the circumstances, that it's basically, Formula One's first decade was basically just, I want to say it was just a cowboy show, where it's like, I mean, it was the Colosseum at the height of Rome. Whatever happened, happened.
And this was also in an era where one crash was most likely going to be your last.
Yeah, where seatbelts were not only not mandatory, they were discouraged against, because it was seemed safer to be launched freely away from the car than sit in the rolling metal death trap.
When you put it like that. Oh, sweet Jesus. But yeah, Fangio was a weapon, and... Just a mark of his era more than anything
In every full season he participated in Formula One, he either finished first or second.
Yeah. Again, it's just like when it comes to F1 greats, he is Genesis more than anything else. And he's still only just outside the top 10 for wins at 24. And he only ever took part in 49 races?
Yes. It's like...
24 out of 49.
Like, baseball has Babe Ruth, cricket has Bradman, but we have Fangio.
We have Fangio. He was the first, more than anything else, and that is why, in both our eyes, he is the greatest driver of all time. And, yeah, I think we're going to But, yeah, that was fun. Please feel free to leave your top 10 lists in comments and whatnot. If you mention them, I might get a chance to feature them in the next episode. And hopefully, just one more disclaimer: this is not fact. This is just our subjective opinions. Please treat them as
I
don't such.
I'm willing to put down Fangio as fact.
yeah, you know what, that's the top three on my list is almost dead nailed on at this point, and it's going to take something quite hefty to dislodge that top three.
Yeah,
ever,
try your hardest, Lewis. I would love to see you, like, just break into the top three.
Ain't happening. But I hope you guys enjoyed the show. Feel free to subscribe on iTunes if you haven't already. And please, if you like the show, leave a review. It really helps us out. You know, iTunes needs us. You know, we need to be on the front page, man. I'm telling you. But I hope you guys enjoyed the show. And yeah, hopefully see you guys next week to talk about some testing and obviously some inevitable jokes when New England news the Super Bowl. To
Let's go Seattle. Right. Go Hawks.
Shut up. Until next time, from me and Ryan, we'll catch you guys next time. Sayonara.
See ya.